I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Stephen Quinn joins me now. I only met him for the first time about a year ago, but it's odd what radio does. A lot of us feel like we've known him for a long time, whether it's waking up to him in the morning with CBC Radio 1's The Early Edition, or all those years he was holding court in the afternoons on the coast, or during those years when he was a terrific municipal affairs reporter at the Public Broadcaster or at CKNW, where a lot of us first noticed his work over 20 years ago now. He's played a central part in the conversation in this town. He's won many awards for his work as a journalist and broadcaster. He's lent his name to many good organizations, often emceeing and hosting events. He's so busy, so ubiquitous, that it's been a long time that I've wanted him on this program. And as I wrap up year 15 of this podcast, it's delightful to have him here. I'll ask him about his work, about the elements that make The Early Edition the program of record in this town, as well as his storied career. There are less than five good, solid political interviewers in this province, and there's no doubt Quinn is one of them. I've long admired his skill at asking questions, whether they're with politicians who'd rather be elsewhere, or ordinary people who have a story to tell. There's one outstanding interview that I'll cite that Stephen did with a woman who might have lost family members in the Philippines during Typhoon Haiyan. With such grace and sensitivity, he gleaned information from his guest, yet as she was obviously devastated, he allowed her to express her emotions without it all sounding exploitative. You can listen to the early edition of a program Mr. Quinn has hosted since December 2017, weekdays at 5 a.m. straight through to 8:37 a.m. He's also the host of a new podcast, Sanctioned, written by the estimable Jason Proctor. The show examines the many facets to the arrest of Meng Wanzhou. This past December, it's not just about the arrest or possible extradition to the United States, but also about Huawei and its global reach, 5G, and so much more. There's also the terrific podcast he did last year, Sold, which was on the Vancouver housing crisis. Visit cbc.ca/bc for more. The Twitter handle is at CBC Stephen Quinn. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Stephen Quinn. Mr. Quinn, good morning.
Hello to you.
I'm out of breath, so do you mind just vamping at
all?
Well,
that's because your intro is really, really long. Thank you for having me, and I'm so glad to finally make it here. I feel terrible for not getting here until now, and I love being in this room because this is unbelievable in here.
It's a bit of a mess, but as I say, you know, as I tell people, I know where everything is. So, I want to talk about Sanctioned because I'm on episode two right now. And how many are there?
Six episodes for now. There will be more on the way. We're waiting for something definitive to happen.
As the story develops,
exactly.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. What also impressed me is it's so well written. It's elegantly
Jason
written.
Proctor. It's all about Jason Proctor. He wrote it. He, in fact, created it. It was his idea. His writing, I would get the scripts. My role in it is very limited. Jason is the writer. Vivian Luck is the producer of it. Teresa Duval is the executive producer of it. And I got the great privilege or had the great privilege of getting to read Jason's words. And I would look forward to a script like it was a fine piece of literature because I didn't know what was going to happen next.
Yeah.
And so the script sort of dribbled out over a couple of weeks. And as I got them, you know, they're so dramatic, so cinematic, in fact.
Yeah.
You know, Jason writes everything in scenes. Yeah. He's an amazing dramatic writer. And he took all of these details from court documents and congressional hearings and, you know, articles that he had found online and bits of videotape, and he himself being there in the courtroom, he himself observing Meng Wanzhou as she made those appearances and, you know, showed up in her prison sweats and so on. And he took all of these elements and sewed it together into this amazing drama. So, you know, it sounds like a drama, but every bit of it is true. He just did a masterful job.
Yeah, and, you know, I, like everybody else, followed this case. There's stuff in there that I learned that I didn't know before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's the great thing about the work that you all have done with that show.
Well, again, Jason does what it does with this. I think sometimes it's important to go, you know, there's nothing that groundbreaking or new in it. But again, it's the way it's the way it's sewn together.
Yeah.
And it's the origins of the story with Steve Stucklow, the Reuters reporter,
mm-hmm.
who broke the ZTE story, which led to the Huawei story. And there's just the sheer drama of what's going on here and how you have the CFO from the world's biggest telecommunications company sitting in house arrest in Vancouver. And it's wild.
Yeah. Another thing that's on the early edition that I'm enjoying a great deal is Matheson.
Mm-hmm.
Jason D'Souza, He's embedded is the right word. He's in the classroom.
Yeah.
Following. By the way, how did you pick this high school in Surrey?
We looked for. I didn't choose it. Our producers chose it, and and Catherine Rolfson, who's the producer of the early edition, put out feelers to the Surrey School Board. We knew we wanted to do something in Surrey specifically, because it's got such a young community and it's such a diverse population. And I don't know where the idea came from, but one day Jason was doing North by Northwest, sitting in for Cheryl McKay one weekend, and I went upstairs and I said, how would you feel about hanging around in a high school for a month? And I had it in my head that if we wanted to do it right, we needed to make a commitment to actually having a reporter there all the time. Mm-hmm. We did an editorial board with a number of South Asian community leaders in Surrey some time ago, last year, maybe 14 months ago, and they were great. They were very honest about what they thought of the way we were covering the community. And the biggest criticism was, you guys only show up when somebody gets shot. Mm. Otherwise, you're not here to report on what's actually happening in the community. You're not here to report on, the achievements of young people in the community, or just on an everyday basis. So I thought about that, could we get into a high school? Could we get a reporter in there? Will my bosses say yes to committing one person to going to school for an entire month? Will the Surrey School Board say yes to it? Is there any principal in their right mind who would say yes to it? How are the teachers going to feel? How are the students? It amazingly all came together because everybody said yes. And, Jason went into it with such enthusiasm and such buy-in. And it's a difficult, it's a difficult project. I mean, I said, you know how it feels when you get thrown into something that's out of your element. You kind of get something in the pit of your stomach. Your instinct might be to shut down or flee or something. He did the opposite. He just pushed himself through it. And he had a grade 11 class schedule. So he was going from class to class with the students. And it wasn't a 21 Jump Street thing. He wasn't disguising himself as a student. Everybody knew who he was. They gave him an office in the library where the kids could come to him to talk. So he'd close the door or he could have a private conversation with them. And, the result has been, today was about kids with disabilities. It was heartbreaking and enlightening, and actually left me feeling really hopeful at the end of it.
Yeah.
And sorry, I'm dating this by saying that, but episode after episode, he won the trust of the kids and they talked to him openly, and we're getting to hear a high school and inside a high school the way we don't hear it very much.
Did he have a chance to do the work itself? I mean, the homework that the kid's doing, did he find it a challenge?
No, he didn't have to do the homework. Yeah. His homework was getting back after a day of rolling tape and transcribing everything for, 20 days worth of material after a month there, and then trying to figure out, I guess, what the thread was and what stories he was going to tell.
Yeah, one listens to it, extremely hopeful because, this is obviously the future.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful thing from last week where he talks to a girl who doesn't really have very many friends.
Yeah.
I mean, it's heartbreaking, but at the same time, the way that she comports herself and the way that she reacts to that sort of being ostracized, it leaves you really. The kids are all right, aren't they?
They are. And what I found, I think that was the episode, was the party, and it was about people organizing a party and about, the politics of who's going to get invited and not invited and who's excluded. And, I was listening to that, and you kind of get something in the pit of your stomach because we've all been there.
Sure.
We've all been left on the outside of something. And when you're at that, tender age of being 15 or 16 or 17 years old, it feels like the end of the world.
Yeah. Another segment that I like on the show is parental guidance.
Yes.
That Amy Bell does, and I wish I was on regularly, like say once a week rather than every couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of work for Amy, a lot of work for Amy. I love it because Amy and I talk about parenting and our kids all the time, and she is exactly the same in parental guidance as she is when she's just talking to me about it on the side of her desk, which is, we both complain, we call our children nasty names, and then we get on with that, and then we both end with, but we love them, don't we? Yeah, we do. I mean, I really appreciate her take on parenting, which is, you know, it's not easy, and, you know, it's not Facebook, that's for sure.
Yeah. One segment, though, that we haven't heard in a while is Quinn's Quiz. Will that ever come back?
I'm going to say no.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, I think my bosses would like to you know, here's the thing. That started when I was a City Hall reporter, and it started as a segment on the early edition. You probably know that. And it started because I had all of this leftover tape, because City Hall was insane at the time. And I had all this leftover tape and nothing to do with it. And none of it would fit into a news story or a, you know, a tape talk feature or the sorts of things we do. A lot of it was just outlandish, and I was looking for a place to put it. And they were looking for some sort of quiz format, and I said, what about a municipal affairs quiz? And they didn't, I didn't know what it was going to be until, you know, the outrageous tape I was bringing back dictated what it was. And it was fun. I had a lot of fun with it for a long time. But it started to turn into a bit of a slog toward the end on the coast. And just, you know, by way of, I think things run their course, and then they're done, and, you know, it's over, and everybody's okay with that.
McElroy's Quiz, what about that?
I don't know if I want that. It's bad enough. You get that guy starts ranking stuff, and we're in trouble. But you look at the response he gets,
right?
Like the biggest thing on Canadian TV that he did. I don't know, they got like 500,000 or 600,000 replies or something crazy.
When you became the permanent host of the early edition almost 18 months ago, was there discussion as to how you'd change it from your predecessor? Because at the same time, it's a show that works, regardless of who hosts it.
No, and it was wildly successful under Rick Clough. I didn't go in there with the idea of changing it, but I'm a different person than Rick is. I have a different style of interviewing than Rick does. And I think just that by itself was going to change the show a little bit. You know, you just called it the show of record, or a show of record, which is exactly what I would like the show to be referred to as.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I would like us to be. We're not there every day. And, you know, we have good days and we have days that, you know, aren't the best. But the good days are starting to outweigh the ones that aren't the best. And that's not a criticism of anything or anyone. It's just the nature of it. You know this. You know, you get a lot of podcasts that probably work out to your satisfaction, and some probably not so much. And I tend to take it really personally, because for all of the hard work, all of the associate producers and the producers put into it, it ends up in my hands, and I end up having to be the person to deliver it. And either I do a good job of that, or I don't do a good job of that. And, you know, you're only, well, as a reporter, you always say you're only as, you know, good as the last story. For me, I feel like I'm only as good as my last interview. Like, was it successful?
When you're doing the show from 5 a.m. right through to the current, the audience, obviously, in the morning it changes every half hour, every hour, because, you know, people are going to work or they're doing things. Did you feel that? I mean, do you feel like at a certain period there are more people listening than in another?
Well, you know, Joe, we got these things called ratings. So I can see exactly when people wake up. The majority of the audience starts listening. I mean, we get a big spike right before 7 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
Just before 7 o'clock is where we get a big spike in listenership. But we're also, and again, this is probably less to do with me, more to do with people like Jack Costello and George Baker, who has replaced Lee Rosevere as our technician. Our 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock hour is doing quite well, which sounds crazy, but we've got this really loyal listenership.
Yeah.
You know, who's also very active on Twitter
at
5 o'clock in the morning. And I kind of like that, because it feels sort of like, you know, it's a small club or something. And again, it's not a club that's exclusive. In fact, we invite more people in all the time. And I love that first hour. You know, 6 to 7 is our televised hour, which I am completely unaware of, as you can tell by my attire. But 7 o'clock, just before 7, is when people wake up. So, yeah, people are in a very different state all the way through the morning. I think we are conscious of that.
Uh-huh.
You know, we try to, you know, I'm a news junkie, and I would like to do hardcore accountability interviews all day, every day. That's not necessarily, though, what people want to hear in the morning. They want that, but they want a little bit of release as well, sure. I think, and a little bit of humor and a little bit of, you know, hearing something about what's going on in their neighborhood.
I mean, when the wake-up song comes on, mm-hmm. that's about the time that I'm heading to bed, right?
That's right.
But I love that first hour when Jake is there, Yvette is there, and you guys are just chatting.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, and then Amy comes in, and you know, it's good morning, but I mean, it feels, comfortable is not the right word, but it feels familiar, and I think that's what makes it, I mean, you know, a must-listen for a lot of people every day.
I feel that way about radio generally, though. You know, I have my favorite programs that I listen to.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big NPR fan. I listen to On the Media all the time with Bob Garfield and Brooke Gladstone.
Mm-hmm.
And if Bob or Brooke isn't there for 1 week, you know, I wait, and he says, this is On the Media, I'm Bob Garfield, Brooke Gladstone is away. And yeah. I go, oh, Brooke Gladstone's away. You do get I've interviewed Brooke a couple of times.
Uh-huh.
I've never interviewed Bob. But these are like people you know, and it's, you know, you get your head ready for where you know they're going to take you.
Yeah.
And if there's a little change, it actually does, you know, it has a small impact on you.
Is the show easier to do when the weather's nicer? Because I know a lot of people listen to the radio, especially morning radio, mm-hmm. when, you know, the weather's crap, when it's snowing,
oh, yeah.
schools are closed. I mean, you know, that becomes a, you know, required listening, if you will. But when the weather's nicer, the sun's out earlier, do you feel the audience different as well? I mean, I don't know how it is for you getting up in the morning.
I don't know. That's a great question. Because when the weather's bad, and if we have like a weather event, like a snowstorm or something, then you're right. The show does become mandatory listening. And we're really aware of that. I mean, that'll be a morning where I'll say to Amy, you know, take as much time as you need. And, you know, with traffic and weather, or we'll bring in, you know, Johanna Wagstaff or a meteorologist. Mm-hmm. We'll bring, you know, somebody in to tell us more about it because, you know, weather is the ultimate impact story, right? Especially, I mean, bad weather. On the sunny days, I don't know. You know, it's interesting because as we kind of edge our way into summer here, I don't get a sense that the listenership is changing right now. Long weekends are kind of a fun thing.
Yeah.
You really do feel like you're sending people off
and
then welcoming them back. I pushed forever when I was on the afternoon show to make sure that we were there on a Monday of a long weekend. Even if the Monday was a holiday. And my colleagues thought I was crazy. I said, please, 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 can we be on the air on Monday afternoon from 3 until 6, because that's when everybody's coming back into town, and that's when they need us. And if we're not there, they're going to turn to something else. And I want them to listen to something else. Yeah. I want them to listen to us.
Yeah.
And my bosses, you know, finally decided that made sense, and we started doing it. So I was really, really happy with that. I mean, being there, you know, live radio, you know, what you do in podcasting and everything else that we can listen to as far as audio goes or audiobooks, live radio when you need it is
nothing. There's nothing better.
I love it.
Yeah. When you do the show, I mean, people must ask you what time you wake up in the morning. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get that question probably at the grocery store.
3:25.
Right? Really?
Yeah.
The other thing is the news nowadays. I mean, it seems to me, especially with whoever's in the White House now, there's news every morning. What's that like? I mean, do you often find that scripts are thrown out because of something breaking?
Yeah, more and more. And you're absolutely right. I mean, there's more happening every morning. I try to keep up on it before I go to bed at night. Here's my problem with this new shift is that I generally don't get to sleep until about 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get up at 3:25. And so I'm getting about 5.5 hours sleep every night. Try to get a nap in the afternoon if I can, but I have kids. They don't care that I get up at 3:25 in the morning. they need me to do what I need to do. But trying to keep up on it at night, it's not just that there's more news, it's all of the sources, you know, of news. And it's social media as well, because the assumption is that we've all been monitoring it around the clock.
Sure.
Every day,
yeah.
And that we know everything that's happened. I walked in one morning couple of weeks ago, and there had been some major break in something overnight, and I didn't know about it, and I felt like, what happened? How did I miss that? And I missed it because I went to bed at 9 o'clock that night.
Mm.
So, and I, you know, I didn't, and I listened to Metro Morning out of Toronto in the morning, to sort of hear what, you know, what they're deciding are going to be their stories of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my first half hour of radio listening, is listening to Matt Galloway.
Did he or Gregor and Victoria or Rick even give you advice as to or tips to, as you took on this new shift?
No, I asked them about it. And everybody handles it differently. Mike Finnerty in Montreal, he's actually just taken a 7-month leave because he's been doing the show for, I think, at least 7 years in Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he has a real regime that he does to get through the day. He's, you know, he does the show, does the meeting, eats a light meal, goes to the gym, takes a nap, wakes back, you know, and it, like clockwork
yeah.
every day. I'm terrible at that. I have, since I started the show, I think I've put on about 20 pounds because when I get home, you know, after noon, I
yeah.
just want to eat stoner food and fall asleep.
Yeah.
I'll eat anything with cheese on it.
I've interviewed people who've done the Today Show and Canada AM, and
yeah.
they say no matter how long you do it, 20 years, you can never get used to the hours.
This is not encouraging, Joe. Yeah, I'm tired all the time, and it's the frustration is that, you know, you're not as sharp as you could be all the time. You know, I feel sharp when I walk into work in the morning.
Yeah.
What's funny is it's this great contradiction. I mean, alarm goes off 3:25. I get out of bed, get into the shower, get out the door by about 5 to 4. I don't live far away, so I grab an Evo or a car to go or ride my bike,
yeah.
and I can get to work in, you know, 5 or 10 minutes. And I'm always glad to walk in the door. And when I walk in the door, any, you know, exhaustion or fatigue sort of falls away as we get into what we're going to do
yeah.
in the morning. And my problem is that we have our editorial meeting at 9:45. And I, after all of the adrenaline of the 3.5 hour performance has drained
sure.
out of you, I actually start nodding off in those meetings, and it's not good, but it's, you know, I don't know what to do about it because I'm not getting enough sleep, Joe.
Yeah, what's your coffee intake?
Oh, that's a good question. I drink the crappiest coffee.
Do you?
Well, if Jake's there, Jake makes really good coffee. And I pitch into buying the coffee, but the first thing I'll do is go for the Keurig machine and the superstore no-name coffee pods.
I guess nothing's really open at like 4 in the morning, is there?
Well, yeah, McDonald's is downstairs,
sure.
or I could go to the Sev, but, you know, the scene at the corner of Hamilton and Robson
yeah.
at 4 o'clock on a weekday morning, I would avoid that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I grew up listening to Frosty in the
yeah.
morning. A lot of people in this town did. That sort of show, I mean, that's not obviously what you do, but I mean, when you look at a guy like that and the longevity of that,
mm-hmm.
Do you find, because now that I think about it, Drew, Amy
yeah.
worked on that show for
did she?
A while, yeah. Do you look at say, things that work for other people and, say, pick them up for yourself, maybe?
I'll be perfectly honest with you. I don't really know Frosty's show. I was a CBC listener
mm-hmm.
when I was going to BCIT.
Sure.
And the first time I listened to CKNW was when I started going to BCIT. And everybody said, well, you have to listen to CKNW. And I said, okay, what's that? And it took my ears a little bit getting
yeah.
used to after, you know, years and years of listening to CBC.
Sure, yeah.
And eventually I got used to it, but I never did really get into... Every time I listened to the morning show, here was the thing, and no disrespect at all to Frosty, who was great, but it was kind of the humor was kind of mean. Like, there was always, like, a target at the... When it came to, you know, they'd make fun of people who are on TV.
Sure.
They'd
yeah,
make
yeah.
fun of people because of how they looked. And, oh, did you see what she was wearing or something like that?
Yeah.
And I know it wasn't legitimately mean, but it wasn't...
it was dated.
It was dated. It felt old-fashioned.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was like a little bit of sort of like celebrity gossip culture, which I really do not care about.
Yeah.
And
I guess Stern was big in the 80s and 90s, Howard Stern, that is.
Yeah.
And I think maybe morning, I mean, it did change morning radio all across the English-speaking language, if you will, that people were doing mean.
People felt emboldened.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I know all about Howard Stern.
Yeah.
I don't know that I've ever listened to a whole episode of his program.
Very few of us have serious subscriptions. I think that's the thing. Well, once it expires, very few of us renew them. You grew up in Ottawa, is that right?
I did.
Yeah. One would assume that growing up there, I guess you just have to pick up the interest in politics automatically. Was that the case with you?
I don't know where it came from. I mean, you're right. It's weird, you know, standing waiting for your bus outside the Parliament buildings when you come back from school every day and watching all of the TV reporters at 4 o'clock doing their stand-ups, getting ready to, you know, send them to the news. Major public events take place there. You know, when other world leaders came to town, we would sometimes I saw Ronald Reagan on Parliament Hill.
Yeah,
being heckled and Pierre Trudeau at the time saying, "Hey guys, when I go to the United States, I don't get this kind of reception." And I went to a downtown high school, which was it's a really interesting school. It was called Lisgar Collegiate. Sheila Rogers went there.
Mm-hmm.
Lorne Greene went there. Peter Jennings went there.
But all at different times.
Times. Yeah. Not sorry, Sheila. Sheila Rogers, for the record, was not in the same year as
Lorne Greene. No, hope not. Yeah.
No, but it was this wacky little downtown high school. It was, it wasn't little. It was about 1,200 students, I think. I've been thinking about it a lot since Matheson, actually, because that's taken me back. And the Governor General's daughters went there. A lot of diplomat kids went there.
Right.
And the diplomat kids went there because it was a public school.
Uh-huh.
And they wanted the optics of their kids going to a public school. But it was a very academically inclined public school with a very you know, high standard. And so, you know, they could boast about sending their kids to public school at the same time knowing that they're in pretty good hands academically.
Yeah.
But it was funny going there with the Schreier...
Ed
Schreier's, yeah, Ed Schreier's daughter,
Ed and Lily,
Lisa and Carmel.
Uh-huh.
And Carmel was in my class. Lisa was a year ahead of me, but I got to know them, and we used to occasionally go to Government House. So yeah, I mean, does that make me, you know, is it politics by osmosis? You know, probably not. I mean, I wasn't that political in high school.
And then what brought you out here?
A girl,
really?
Yeah.
And then because I was reading various articles about you. You didn't go to BCIT right out of high school.
No, I was 30.
Yeah.
So I moved here. I'd worked in the restaurant business in Ottawa. I got out of high school and graduated from grade 13. Really had not much idea of what I wanted to do. I had a girlfriend at the time who was going to school in London, England, to train to be a Montessori teacher.
Mm-hmm.
She got a job in West Vancouver. And so we got a drive-away car from Montreal, and I was 20 years old. And we jumped in the drive-away car and got here and, you know, set up house.
Now, when you're 20 and you're doing other jobs, obviously, before going to BCIT, was journalism in the back of your mind that was something you wanted to do?
It was. I volunteered at Rogers Community Television for a long time. Somewhere there are terrifyingly bad tapes of me at Rogers Community Television doing a current affairs program called Freestyle. Along with a couple of other people, I still see some of those people around. One of the producers is still in the business. His name's Mike Keeping. He also does Foley work for movies and stuff. But I learned how to do everything there at community television. I learned how to, you know, they were really good. They ran workshops they would bring in real journalists and teach us how to do stuff. I took some part-time classes at BCIT in television production as well at the time, but I didn't settle on the journalism thing until, you know, I learned how to shoot and edit and do a little bit of writing and that kind of thing. I had this rather ill-fated move to Montreal many years later. So I moved to Montreal temporarily, thinking I was going to go back to school in Montreal, thinking I'd go to Concordia. And it didn't pan out. And I was working for this company called ISTS Telav, which does audio production and, you know, staging and audio production and simultaneous translation. So here I am, an Anglophone, you know, in Montreal, not able to speak French. I'm embarrassed about that, by the way, coming from Ottawa. I should be able to speak French. working for a simultaneous translation company.
Yeah.
And we, this sounds technical or boring, forgive me, but it does get me to the point, which is we used to have to attend a lot of government meetings and stuff like that because simultaneous translation was required.
Big business, yeah.
Yeah, so you'd put it, you know, and you'd have to go in and you'd have to set up all of these infrared radiators and all of the amps. You'd do all the sound for the thing. So they would just basically do all the AV for the thing. And I found myself in places where I probably shouldn't have been, where reporters weren't allowed in. When there were, you know, government meetings taking place with federal government officials. So I ended up sitting there behind a soundboard in all of these kind of closed door meetings, listening to what was going on around me. I already had an interest in journalism, but I was sitting there thinking, holy shit, this is news.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the reporters are outside, and I got to sit in here, and I know exactly what happened. It was interesting to me because they never made me sign any agreement of confidentiality or anything like that. Not that I would have.
Uh-huh.
And one of them, I remember I was taking notes on a steno pad, and not for any reason other than I was interested in the subject. I think it was a telefilm meeting.
Yeah.
And it was at the Chateau Montebello, in fact, and it was a telefilm meeting there. And so we were sitting in the room on one of the first days before the bigger part of the meeting started with just the executive. And I was taking notes, and then someone else walked by and said, oh, somebody forgot their notebook. And I said, no, that's mine. And they thought it was a little strange that I was, you know, keeping notes or taking notes. That didn't last long. I was only in Montreal for like a year and a half. But when I got back, I ended up, you know, applying to the full-time program at BCIT.
So when you get to see the system and how it works like that, it must inform sort of the questions that you would ask of politicians who go on the record as they do with you.
Yeah, you get to watch a lot of, I mean, watching other people ask questions taught me a lot. One of my internships was in the legislature, and Robin Piercy, who was the person who was running the program at BCIT, he was basically in charge of the journalism department. He was an old CBCer from way back. I have tremendous respect for him, a Newfoundlander, and he was a mentor to me in a lot of ways. And he had an internship at the legislature, and he asked me if I wanted to do it, and I said sure. And so I went over there for a month and lived in, you know, rented somebody's room in Oak Bay. And went to the ledge every day. And within a couple of days of getting there, Glenn Clark called an election.
Mm.
And then all the reporters left the building. They all got on the buses and left the building. I was working with Kim Emerson at CKNW.
Yeah.
And so I got left in the basement of the legislature with nobody around and nothing going on, thinking, well, this sucks. And then it occurred to me, I thought, well, it doesn't suck. All the reporters are gone. I'm the only reporter left in the building. I mean, flattering myself by calling myself a reporter at the time. But I started to find stories, and I started filing them to CKNW, and CKNW started playing them. And I remember going upstairs, and I was on and off in the legislature a couple of times, not for any great length of time, but I remember being in the speaker's corridor, where you had to wear a jacket and tie, and the scrums that used to take place, and I'd get my, you know, microphone into a scrum to catch spit, and I always watched Vaughn Palmer, who was never in the scrum.
Yeah.
He was never in the crowd. He was always over there, leaning against the wall with his hand on his chin, watching the bigger picture. And then he would walk in and just throw a dart. And everybody would stop because he always asked good questions. And then he would back out of the scrum and cross his arms and listen. And I thought that was the coolest thing. I thought that he had chosen a different perspective than just getting into somebody's face. He was, you know, watching the bigger picture.
Yeah.
And I think that really is, you see that obviously in his writing and his reporting. I mean, he's a great writer and a great reporter. But I think I learned a lot from scrums because, you know, there's the limited time. There's the confrontational part of it, which is you are standing toe-to-toe with somebody.
Yeah.
You know, you're right there in their face. And you either hold your own or you don't. And the only way to hold your own is to know your stuff. Because if you don't know your stuff, and if you reveal that you don't know your stuff, they will kill you.
Right. You have a line in your Twitter bio. It's been there for a while now, raising awareness.
Yeah, that's sarcastic.
Do you think it is?
I think it is.
I think, it seems to me, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that you're somebody who views your job as more than a reporter, more than a broadcaster. That doing whatever show you're doing is doing something to raise awareness in the wider community.
Yeah, I mean, that came from a Matthew Lazin Ryder joke about having a benefit to raise awareness for raising awareness or something like that.
Sounds like him, you know.
To me, it's just one of those, meaningless phrases that we throw out there all the time, right? I never want to, do you ever want to read an intro that says that, so-and-so is raising awareness for... It's just such a weird phrase. That's what it's doing in there. But I like your interpretation of it. I think that's... I had not thought about it that way. And I don't think... I don't know. I can't imagine anybody would look at that and know me and take it seriously. But you're right. I mean, to me, there is a bigger... you don't want to be too grand about it or too lofty about it.
No.
But I do feel like we have a special responsibility, I think, at the public broadcaster. And I do take that really, really seriously. I mean, I look back over, all of the decades that CBC has been running, and you're part of this legacy. And I'm conscious of that all the time. But I want people to, I just want people to know how stuff works. I want people to know why those decisions are being made. I want to bring people some transparency. I want to try to pull back the curtain a bit and show people how stuff works. And part of that is, trying to get the truth out of people,
sure,
which is next to impossible.
Yeah.
Especially now when everybody just says anything.
You have a marvelous technique, especially when you have a politician who just doesn't want to answer a question. And you say, yes, but that's not the question I asked. And I love listening to that whenever that happens because, as someone who asks questions, I can understand where you're coming from and.
You can go back to, there's always that. Trying to figure out if you're just going to spend all 8 minutes asking the same question 10 different ways, 10 different times, are you serving your audience if you do that? Or do you ask it 3 times, realize they're not going to do it, and just move on?
Yeah.
And who was it? It was Rosie Barton who did on Power and Politics when she was anchoring it, said to, I don't remember who the politician was.
Chris Alexander?
Yeah, are you going to answer the question?
Yeah.
No, you're either going to answer the question or you're not going to answer the question. If you're not going to answer the question, just tell me and we can move on.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a stroke of genius.
Yeah. When you're at the fore of a lot of the important conversations we're having in the city, and not just at election time, that makes the job all the more important. It conveys, I would assume, some responsibility on you as the host.
It does. It's different because as a host, I feel as though things get to be much more considered than they were when I was a reporter. To me, here's the exciting thing. I mean, being a host is great, but I always think of myself as a reporter first, I think. But being an in-the-field reporter with... this, your notepad in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
I'll make noise. Having your notepad and a pen and having to, sit through 4 hours of city council, decide what's important, decide what you're going to focus on, write it, and then present it to people for the first time. You know, nobody's ever heard this news before. You're the person with the news. I have the news right here in my hand. I'm going to tell you the news from this notepad right now. You know, that's exciting. It's also a bit daunting because it's all you.
Yeah.
You know, you're a reporter out in the field, and especially in radio, you know, you jot it down on a pad, you grab your tape clip, and you hold, well, in the old days, you hold up your phone to your tape recorder,
right.
and that's your news story. And if you get it wrong, or get anything wrong, it's not coming back. It's already out there,
yeah.
right? There's no silent rewrite like you can do in a web story now and pretend the mistake never happened. It's out there. So the responsibility of being a reporter, gathering all of that information firsthand and doing it under the gun and, you know, turning it around and making sense out of it, it's different than it is hosting. Hosting is like the, you know, you're just waiting to for that stupid career-ending thing to come out of your mouth. And hopefully you pause long enough that it doesn't.
The other thing that I've admired about your work is when you were on in the afternoons, you really cultivated a sense of community amongst the audience. Twitter, I guess, really helped with that. I mean, I'm not near a radio at 3 p.m., but I would follow along with your tweets, Lisa's tweets, Matthew's tweets, and I would contribute and then come home at, say, 11 and then listen to the show.
Yeah, we love that.
But I mean, you know, it came to the point that where listeners were meeting up for beers and things like that, weren't they?
It's true. Yeah, we had, it was called an OCTTU, an on the coast tweet up. And so a bunch of listeners from very different backgrounds all got together at a pub every now and then. And I don't know if they still do it, but there were a number of them, just terrific people, all of them. And the only thing they had in common, they didn't know each other. Mm-hmm. And the only thing they had in common was that they were all listeners of On the Coast. And they came together. And to me, that was just a remarkable thing. But there really was, and, you know, and I hope this comes through a little bit on the early edition as well. You know, there really is a community of listeners, and we want it to get bigger all the time. In the afternoon show, though, we really felt that the afternoon show, you know, when I started doing that show, it was not the highest rated show on the air. Not that it ever was when I did it. It was, again, you know, ratings are a weird thing, especially for CBC, which doesn't sell advertising. The show did not have the listenership, though, that we all would have liked at the time. And I remember one of my colleagues at the time, one of these, you know, one of our associate producers saying, you know, I work too damn hard to be on the eighth place show or whatever we were, wherever we were in the ratings at the time. And it was very, very organic that it became what it was. And a big part of that was the audience, was listening to the audience. When Twitter came along, I glommed onto it pretty fast because I thought, oh my gosh, now it's not just a one-way enterprise anymore.
Yeah.
I have this beside me, and I'm hearing back in real time about what's coming out of my mouth. I don't have to wait to pull the tape off of the talkback line, or I don't have to scroll through the email to find what people are saying. They're saying it to me right now in real time. And that changed a lot. And I think that allowed for us to be more engaged directly with our audience, to learn stuff from the audience. This morning somebody tweeted a question that I asked Catherine McKenna because it was just a good question. And so that's, you know, that's a huge asset as far as live radio is concerned. And it only works for live radio.
Mm-hmm.
So when I go back to, when I used to go back to Toronto to do Q, I'd sit there with Twitter in front of me. It didn't make any sense, though, because we're going, you know, live to Newfoundland right now. And nothing's happening in real time because it's rolling out in a different time zone across the country.
The other aspect, I mean, I mentioned this introduction, getting to know you as we have, was the Globe and Mail column that you did. I think it was 7 years, was it?
7 years.
Yeah. The voice in writing is a lot different than the one that we're used to listening to.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. I mean, you don't feel that way?
Not really. I only know how to write one way, and that was to write for radio. So, you know, one thought per sentence, short sentences, try not to use commas. that sort of thing. I was no genius writer, and when I got asked to submit a column, to try a column out, it was basically, like, I thought, just kind of a rant. But here's the thing. I had to tread a very fine line because while I was writing the Globe and Mail column, I had to adhere to, and this wasn't the Globe and Mail, this was CBC.
Sure.
I had to adhere to the journalistic policies of CBC. So I couldn't go out there and have a, you know, take a really strong position on something because that would reflect the bias when I, you know, got behind the microphone. Yeah, sure, biases were reflected.
But more than that, and I don't think that's even important.
Yeah.
I think it was funny.
Yeah. Yes, it was. Because humor and satire are just about the last way to tell the truth. You know, I feel like I used to joke that I felt like a Russian playwright, you know, trying to like write between the lines, you know, to get the point across, you know, without actually saying the thing out loud. But knowing nudge, nudge, wink, wink, that everybody will get it. Yeah, I love doing that writing. It was, again, daunting in that, you know, the deadlines were brutal. But
yeah.
I worked with some great editors. And I didn't know anything about writing for newspapers.
Yeah.
But I thought, well, this is fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I wrote my whatever it was. It was, I guess it was only supposed to be 800 words a week. It probably ended up being way more. And I loved when I just got to, and the editors were very, very generous with me. And I would say, okay, I have this crazy idea. And they'd go, okay, go do it. And it was amazing to me.
Yeah.
And I mean, I had, and so I did get to, I think, make a lot of, I thought I got to make a lot of points through, you know, writing a lot of just fiction.
Yeah. But a lot of important points, too, on issues, whether it was how a government carried out certain policies on education or...
Mm-hmm.
How City Hall did something that the public was to say, you know, what the community center was like because you'd been there that week or something like that.
Yeah, there was that part of it as well. I mean, it wasn't always bad. I mean, I sometimes ended up in these sort of sentimental moments and I thought about, you know, I mean, we live in a pretty great place.
Yeah.
For all of its problems, we live in a pretty damn fine city. And we do have some great things about the city. Again, to me, the new Trout Lake Community Center was one of them. I love community centers. I mean, is there anything, you know, does anything like warm your heart? Like walking by a community center?
And they're different here than they are in other cities, don't you think?
I really do think so as well. And I mean, here they're, you know, they're really the diversity that you see inside a community center here is very different from what you would see in other places. I mean, in Ottawa, when you say community center, it, you know, it's like social, you know, it's like some social service center
sure,
or something.
Yeah.
It was, well, it's like the word public, right? Public means inferior. I think I wrote about that in the Globe and Mail. You know, oh my God, a public washroom?
Mm-hmm.
You're taking public transit? Oh, you send your kids to public school? You work for public radio? It sounds second tier. I, you know, and there are places, though, where that just is not true.
Right.
You know, it means a good thing. It means that everyone has access to it. So let's fix that.
Yeah.
Let's turn the word public around.
Let's do that, yeah. I want to end with, there's a clip on YouTube of you on an 11 p.m. newscast on CKNW. I guess this would have been 20 years ago or more, right?
Yes.
The great Frank Fong, the late Frank Fong, was the anchor. And it was a Halloween, I guess?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
It was Halloween. I don't remember what the year was. I think it's marked on the YouTube clip. And Frank and I were always looking for crazy stuff to do. Also, we knew that none of our bosses were listening to the 11 p.m. newscast. And so I actually went out. I was out somewhere. I wasn't just sitting next to him, giggling. And we did the lyrics to the Monster Mash as a news story. So I was, you know, Frank and Man was working in his lab late tonight. His eyes begat an eerie sight. A monster of some description from the grave began to rise. And suddenly, and very much to this man's surprise, it did the mash. And Frank said, "Sorry, Stephen, did you say the mash?" And I'd say, "Yes, Frank, the mash." And Frank would say, "The Monster Mash?" See, I can recreate it right now.
Yeah.
Working with Frank Fong was, he was an amazing guy. You've talked to other people from CKNW. You've probably asked about Frank as well. He was just an amazing dude to work with. I worked the night shift for the first couple of years I worked there. I worked with Mike Clark, and Frank was on the desk. And he was hilarious and kind, and he was a hell of a news guy. Like when news broke, boy, he could get stuff out of people. If you heard him working the phones, he had relationships with everybody. he could call, you know, news is a very competitive business, but he could call up another newsroom and talk to people there. And he would, you know, we used to do these hourly checks when you work in radio, but not almost hourly checks, you know, call every police department in the lower mainland. Hi, anything up? No, thanks. Bye. This, that's how NW did it. Yeah. Right. That's how they broke all the news all the time. They'd just constantly be calling people. And Frank could get stuff out of people that was just amazing. And, you know, he'd right there just roll tape and write up a news story and get it on the air. And he did some great stuff. But he loved to have fun. And he used to come in, you know, I think our shift started at 4 or 5 o'clock or something. And he'd come in wearing socks and sandals and shorts, which he always wore. He would put on a kimono that he kept in the closet. And he would sit down, and that was Frank's outfit. Basically a T-shirt, a kimono, socks and sandals. And the way people, you know, rely on pencils, Frank would always have a chopstick in his hand when he was doing the news. And he came busted out of the booth one day going, "Where's my chopstick?" And because that was his comfort thing that he kept in his hand while he was doing it. He was a fabulous, fabulous guy. He moved north. Frank was, you probably know, he was a heart transplant recipient. Did amazing work for the Heart and Stroke Foundation. He was the big, huggy, furry mascot for a long time. I was working at CBC. I just started at CBC. And I was doing the City Hall shift, and I was there late one night, and I got a call from him. And he was up north, I think, in Prince George. And he said that he couldn't handle the dialysis anymore. And he was going to stop dialysis. And I said goodbye to him that night. And he said the most amazing thing to me, which was he talked about working as part of a team. And I always felt that way with him and everybody else who, you know, worked that particular shift. You know, it's the hardship of the middle of the night.
Yeah.
But he was just a great guy. I mean, that Monster Mash tape is one thing. You should hear the rest of the Frank Funk tape.
Yeah. I mean, everybody I talk to, you know, has equally memorable, lovely memories of the guy. And I just thought, you know, it's the station's 75th anniversary this year, and it'd be just good to remember someone who, I mean, I grew up listening to him.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of people in this town did as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I talked to David Berner, and he talks about just what fun he was to, you know, because Berner was doing the late night show at the time.
Yeah. No, and he, you know, he and I worked for some reason, I think I had some crazy turnaround or something. I always worked the Saturday morning shift with him. So and we always tried to find something live to do. So we would talk at 7 o'clock in the morning, and he'd say, "Hey, do you want to get out there and get over to here?" And I'd say, "Yeah, sure." And so we would do some live hit first thing in the morning. And it was always, like, I just felt like we were on it all the time. So we were having fun, but I also felt like he was like a crack news guy.
Yeah.
And I learned, you know, a lot from him about writing, because he was also a great writer, great news writer. Here's the funny thing. I mean, so many years later, everybody knows him. I work with Drew now. He and Drew were very close. You know, I work with Sherelle Tobin, who produced Rafe Mayer. I work with Teresa Duval, who produced Bill Good.
Yeah.
You know, I work with Mike Clark, who was the first, the night reporter at NW, who...
Steve Luce.
Yeah, Steve Luce as well, who came just a little bit after me. Oh my God, George Garrett dropped the biggest story in the world with Steve Luce's lab, which was the, like, Millennium Bomber.
Right.
It was, you know, anyhow, that's a whole other story, but all just, you know, amazing people. And I mean, now I'm lucky enough to have a lot of them at CBC, so I feel, you know, I feel like I've won twice. I got to meet them and, you know, work at one place with them, and now they're all back, and some of them are my bosses.
Yeah. Are you going to host The Current?
I'd say not likely. That would require, number one, you know, I don't know that they would have me. Number two is it would involve a move to Toronto. and I don't see myself doing that anytime soon.
I guess you're just so much a part of this town that I think, I mean, you like living here, don't you?
I love this place.
Yeah.
I've never wanted to live anywhere else since I moved here. I rolled up, you know, when, as I said, when I was 20 years old, and I just haven't ever wanted to live anyplace else. I've been back and forth to Toronto a lot, you know, sometimes for 2 or 3 or 4 week periods to work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Toronto's got a lot going for it. It's an amazingly cool, diverse city. You know, the CBC organization there is fantastic. I don't want to live there.
Yeah.
I want to live by the water. Yeah. Or, you know, in a pinch, I'd move back to Montreal.
Right. Yeah. I cannot tell you how delighted I am that you were able to do this. You lead a very busy life, and for you to take the time to do this has just been great for me. You won't understand it. Looking back, that I've been wanting to do this for about 5 or 6 years now.
I know you and I have talked a lot, and I'm so sorry. No, but owe you a giant apology.
But you know, it just worked out. I mean, here you are. You've got an important, a busy job, and you know, I'm wrapping up for the summer. This was just perfect timing. So again, I'm indebted to you for doing this.
Well, thank you so much for your patience, and thanks for having me. And 5 years ago, I would have been an asshole. You wouldn't have wanted to talk to me 5 years ago.
At CBC, Stephen Quinn is the Twitter handle. CBC.ca/BC is the website. Stephen Quinn, join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.